Webster, along with Finette, had decided that because of my audition, it was best not to tell me that my father was in his last days. They did not want to pull my focus away from my preparation. I'll tell you, boy, there are some things you can never quite pardon others for. This, for me, is one such occurrence. That my family would think that it was more important for me to prep for an audition than to be at my father's bedside, it still puzzles and deeply pains me. On the day Emily called to tell me our mother was gone, I fainted momentarily. Once I lifted myself from the floor and picked up the phone again, Emily, through tears, explained how my mother had passed. She'd been dressed in her Sunday best on her way to an appointment in the city. As a precaution while walking the streets of New York, she, like the old-time West Indian woman that she was, always attached her pocketbook to a safety pin and pinned it inside her coat. She'd then carry a decoy pocketbook, an empty one, so that if someone snatched it, the thief would find nothing in it. That's how smart she was. While strolling along the sidewalk, likely scoping out her surroundings, my mother suffered a major stroke. A couple of passers-by spotted her and rushed to her side to try to revive her, but she was already gone. She lay sprawled on the pavement, with her left hand stretched toward heaven, in exactly the position I had dreamed. The woman in my second dream had been her. I never made it to London. Once I hung up the phone, I called my brother in Florida. After he'd left Montclair and his job at the post office, he'd married Bernice. Their union became strained, and they eventually separated. But like our parents, they did not immediately divorce. My brother then joined the Merchant Marines, but having inherited our father's temper, he was dismissed for brawling with a fellow mariner who'd provoked him. Melrose, ever the drifter, moved from here to there, and truthfully, for a time, we didn't know where he was. But at some point, he called my mother and asked for his papers so that he could apply for re-entry into the Merchant Marines. That is how I knew he was living in Florida. And as I see it, it is a miracle that because he'd called asking for his papers, I even knew where to find him when our mother passed. "Come home," I said when he answered the phone. "What's the matter?" he asked. "Just come home," I repeated. "We need you." I met him at the airport with the news that I am sure, based on the quiver in my voice when I'd called him, he was expecting to hear. My poor brother, Mommy's heartstring, crumpled into a heap of wails. My mother did not want to be buried in pink. I don't know why, but she disliked the color. For her funeral, she'd set aside the silk beige gown she'd worn to my sister's wedding decades earlier. Upon inspecting it, I noticed its frayed edges and stains and decided it was not good enough for my mother's journey through the pearly gates. So I went and bought her a gown that would best complement her figure, and it happened to be rose-colored. I've sometimes imagined my mother up in heaven sitting alongside her own mother, recounting scenes from Guiding Light while fussing in a deep West Indian accent about that pink gown and the rebellious last word of her eldest daughter. After my mother's passing, my brother and I were cleaning out her apartment, a sorrowful duty that each time I breathed Mom's scent on a piece of her clothing, felt like losing her all over again. We took apart her queen bed frame, and beneath it, I spotted a stationery box. When I pried it open, a slew of envelopes fell out, letters I'd sent to her over the years. Inside them was a stash of money totaling several $1,000s. Along with my letters, I'd always included checks which she'd cashed but never spent. Instead, she tucked the money in the envelopes, perhaps forgetting the stockpile was there. I used the money to send my daughter Joan, then in her early 30s, on her first trip around the world. "This is your grandmother's gift to you," I said, as I pressed an envelope containing a check into her palm. She whispered, "Thank you." I may never know what my first dream meant, or why the fair-skinned woman resembling Frances appeared. God's ways are indeed a mystery to us mortals, and as the scriptures have proclaimed, we see dimly in this life what we shall one day know in full. And yet my second dream, as well as my mother's own vision, seem undeniable in their message. The woman my mother had envisioned in white had not been me, but her. My instincts had rightly told me that. My mother, in her own way, had foreseen her own passing as clearly as she'd once known that shards of glass would slice open my forearm. The scar that still runs alongside my right wrist reminds me of her prescience. The pain rippling through me in these times now reminds me of losing her. You can never predict how you will feel when your parents pass away. You think you know, but you do not. You may believe you'll be too stunned to speak, and perhaps at moments, the grief will indeed render you voiceless. But your silence may also be punctuated with bouts of wailing, of cowering beneath your covers for days, trying to suspend the bleeding, trying to find the ground beneath you again. You may believe that if you have been estranged from or in conflict with your mother and father, you will experience strange relief upon their passing. None of this, or all of this, may come to pass. The truth is that, like a great many crises in this life, you cannot truly know how you will respond until you are standing in them. There is no preparing. Losing my father and mother felt to me like walking through the world without arms. Your skin is freshly bruised and exposed. The pain is raw. Through death, you realize that the word heartache is not metaphorical, but literal. Every part of you throbs and burns. After the rice and peas and plantains have been brought over by caring neighbors, and once the mourners are long gone, you are left only with the silence, the knowing, the realization that you are on your own. Others you hold dear surround you, of course, but when the people who gave you life have departed this earth, you enter a strange new corridor of detachment. You are untethered, disconnected from the two storylines that gave birth to your one. As much as I adored my father and ached after his passing, I felt the loss of my mother most profoundly. Once our family split apart when I was 9, my mother became the ever-present force in my childhood, the one who wrote most prolifically upon the canvas of who I am. When you bury a parent, you lower his or her casket into the ground, but the history between you lives on. The funeral is an ending, yes, but it is also a beginning, the start of a true reckoning with those hurts between you that must be laid to rest. When we buried my mother, I mourned her then and in the years that followed. As I grieved, I thought I'd long since come to terms with my father, with how he'd both delighted and failed me, with the ways in which he'd unknowingly bruised me, just as all parents do, despite their best intentions. But once Miles stumbled back into my world, I learned just how much of a father wound I was still nursing. 17. The Ladder. With my spirit still ailing from the loss of my mother, I returned to work. When you're black in Hollywood, and frankly, when you're black and doing just about anything in this life, you do not have the luxury of sitting on the sidelines for long. Work beckons amid the reality that when you slow down, so does your income. The wealth gap between blacks and whites in the United States, created by decades of systemic injustice, was as evident in the 1970s as it is now. That gap has always been more pronounced for black women. I don't know one black actress who works with the consistency of a white actress who has the same credentials. That truth holds when it comes to gender. Accomplished artists such as Angela Bassett, Viola Davis, and Halle Berry do not have nearly the same script opportunities as, say, Denzel Washington. And even Denzel, brilliant as he is, has fewer options than white male actors of his caliber. In every aspect of society, we black women find ourselves on the bottom rung of what I call the ladder. We are holding on for dear life, I tell you, surviving as our knuckles bleed. As a black actress, even when you're at the so-called pinnacle of your career, your choices are severely limited. Characters such as Bree Daniels in Clute, the 1971 film role for which Jane Fonda earned an Oscar, come along for a black artist, perhaps once in a career, if at all. How can a black actress ever become a Meryl Streep or a Glenn Close if she cannot build the illustrious body of work that is generally available to actors of that stature? It's impossible. The opportunities are just not there for us, which is why I so strongly encourage the efforts of black scriptwriters and directors. If our stories do not exist in the mainstream, in part because despite evidence to the contrary, the industry's power brokers do not truly believe black protagonists will resonate with white audiences, we do not have the chance to showcase the full extent of our capabilities. That will change only as we continue bankrolling and scripting our own stories. Even when black women are written into a storyline, we are often cast as characters with no evident depth or backstory, largely included as scaffolding to hold up narratives centered on whites. I was quite fortunate to have landed two layered and emotionally complex characters in Rebecca and Jane, though, as you know, I earned practically nothing for them. The women's movement of the 60s and 70s was focused primarily on the needs of middle and upper-class white women, which meant our unique concerns as black women were largely overlooked. Ever present was the reality Zora Neale Hurston wrote of when she called black women the mule of the world in her 1937 novel, Their Eyes Were Watching God. We are subject to the dual scourges of racism and sexism, a reality articulated by the first black woman elected to Congress, Shirley Chisholm. In 1972, Shirley made history again as the first sister to launch a presidential bid as a major party candidate. In the end, she once said, anti-black, anti-female, and all forms of discrimination are equivalent to the same thing, anti-humanism. Shirley understood that we live in a world constantly seeking to reduce us as black women, be it through racism or sexism. The women's movement made its strides, and to be sure, many black women lifted their voices alongside those of whites. But in our America, precious little shifted. And then there's the issue of pay. Even with the same competencies, and often stronger ones, black female artists are routinely paid less than their white colleagues. Out in California, I once ran into renowned actress Alfre Woodard. I was just about to do my daily set of stairs leading up to the beach in Pacific Palisades when I spotted her from a distance exercising with her baby strapped to her chest. She was storming up and down those stairs, boy, as if something had upset her. Alfre, what's the matter with you? I called out to her when she drew close. She looked over and smiled when she realized it was me. "I'm so sick of these blankety blanks not paying me," she said. "I've been in this business 100 years, and they still don't want to pay me what I'm worth." I said to myself, "so it's not just me." Every black woman knows that reality. This country has never valued us. Sure, many now take to the streets, declaring that black lives matter, and I believe the murders of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor have, at last, removed the scales from the eyes of countless whites. I applaud the awakening. Yet in a country that prioritizes commerce above all, a nation where money is always talked louder than rhetoric, the proof of a perception shift will be evidenced in the payment rendered, enough to put us on par, I hope, with less talented whites who've been earning more for decades. It's easy to say black lives matter. The question is, do they matter enough for this nation to treat and compensate them fairly? Historically, the answer has been a resounding no. In 1972, while promoting Sounder, I'd traveled all over the country, speaking to mostly whites, including that journalist who couldn't believe Nathan's son had called him daddy, just as his own son referred to him. How could that be the case if Nathan, as this nation had taught him to believe, was more animal than human? Once I realized such ignorance abounded, I chose to become an ambassador of sorts, helping whites understand what clearly was not apparent to many, that black people experience the full spectrum of human emotion. With the success of the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman in 1974, my platform widened, and I again took to the road. Given that I was turning down roles left and right during the blaxploitation era, there were long stretches when I did not have enough work or enough money, and often both. Speaking is how I remained solvent. For a full month every year throughout the 70s, I toured on college campuses, talking to young people about the roles I'd played, hoping to wield my microphone as a force for good. It was my way of picketing, my contribution to hastening the fulfillment of Dr. King's dream. Following a dry spell in film roles after Jane Pittman, I did play two characters I'm proud of. The first was Coretta Scott King in the NBC miniseries King. I reunited with my co-star in Sounder, Paul Winfield. After our romance had faded, we remained quite fond of one another, a bond that surely bolstered our on-screen chemistry. He took the role of Dr. King, and boy did Paul embody him in both appearance and spirit. I'd never met Dr. King, but by the time I finished the series, I felt like I had. In 1977, Mrs. King, the essence of grace, invited me to stay with her in her Atlanta home while I was researching the role. We spent hours across from each other at her dining room table, covering the terrain of her love story with Martin, whom she'd lost nearly a decade before. He had a wonderful sense of humor, she told me, a light-hearted side the cameras often did not capture. She spoke of the time they traded their well-appointed Georgia home for a much more humble one, because Martin, answering his passion's siren call, wanted to live among the impoverished. "When I was decorating the bathroom," Coretta told me, "I put a simple rug down on the floor in front of the shower and a matching cover on the toilet seat. When Martin saw the toilet seat cover, he said, 'We've got to take this off.' I said, 'What are you talking about?' He said, 'Poor people don't have money to buy food. How are they going to buy a rug just to cover the toilet?'" I thought I would die laughing when she told me that story. So committed was Reverend King to the movement that he wanted every detail of his surroundings to reflect his rallying cry for justice. The same applied to the modest way they dressed their four children. It's both a challenge and a blessing to portray someone who is still alive, The blessing is that the person is a living, breathing body of research you can tap into. The challenge is that there's pressure to get it exactly right. For me, the process of portraying someone living is not markedly different from the one I usually undertake. I listen, I watch, I smell and taste and touch and inhale. I take in every mannerism, every grimace and head turn, every smile and flutter of the eyelids. My intention was never to completely imitate Coretta, and I couldn't have if I'd tried. As an actor, I am not a puppet, but rather an open vessel, a channel through which a character flows. My portrayals are, in essence, an interpretation. With Coretta, I listened for the emotional truth beneath her words and gestures, with the hope of infusing my portrayal with that truth. And as an aside, I initially wore a full head weave for the role, but they brought in a stylist who put in the weave so tight I couldn't even sleep. My head was on fire. It was the first time I'd worn a full weave. It was also the last. "Send that guy back in here to take this stuff out of my head," I told the producer. From then on, I wore a wig. I asked Coretta about losing Martin. I recall seeing images of her at the funeral at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, the way she'd held close in her lap her daughter Bernice, then 5, as she stared straight ahead. She did not shed a tear. From afar, she appeared solemn and unflinching, like a soldier just called into battle. When I met her in person, she was the same. I asked her children whether they'd seen her break down during the week of the funeral. They hadn't, which told me a lot about Coretta. Can you imagine what it takes to hear the news that your husband has been murdered, and then to restrain yourself from falling apart? Do you know the strength that must have been required for her to carry on in such circumstances? The kind of fortitude Black women, time and again, have been called upon to demonstrate. During the few weeks that I spent with Coretta in her home, I never once saw her cry, not even when she was talking about losing this man she loved so much. That does not mean she was not devastated. In her private moments, I am sure she wept. But she knew she had to keep it together for the sake of her children and the country that was watching. She had a job to do, and the grieving would have to wait. That is precisely how I felt when I lost my mother. I did not cry when Emily first told me Mom was gone. My initial shock immediately gave way to an urgent sense of responsibility to carry on with making arrangements. The morning would come later. A fresh wave of grief over my mother's passing had flooded me near the end of 1975 while I was in Russia. I'd landed a role in The Blue Bird, an American-Soviet children's fantasy film based on the 1908 play L'Oiseau Bleu. The film had been slated to begin months earlier than it did, but when I lost my mother, shooting was delayed. Liz Taylor, every bit the grand dame in life as she was on screen, played the lead in the star-studded cast. Jane Fonda and Ava Gardner also had roles. I played Tylette, a cat incarnate. The filming took place in both Leningrad and Moscow. When I arrived in the capital, I was greeted by the sounds of the Russian national anthem, which I knew by heart after all the time I'd spent at that bar in New York, the Orchidean. Even after I'd been in Russia for several weeks, long enough to have gotten past my jet lag, I could not sleep well. I'd awaken in the middle of the night howling, "Mama, mama, mama." One evening, I must have wept for 3 hours straight. By then, my mother had been gone for a year, and yet it was the first time I'd been able to fully release my sorrow, like exhaling after holding my breath for months. The Blue Bird was trouble from the beginning. George Cukor, the American director, assembled a Russian crew, most of whom could not speak a lick of English. How is it that you're shooting a film in a foreign country and do not bring in a Russian translator or associate director? It was a mess. And George, who often reverted to sign language to get his point across to the crew, should have known better. The whole process was one big argument after another. At one point, my role required me to fly, leaping into the air toward a passing bird. The crew hoisted me up on ropes, with the non-English-speaking cinematographer down below, poised to film the shot. As I swung, he clearly was in the wrong position to capture the scene. He started screaming out directions in Russian, like I could understand him. I was directed to shoot the scene again, so I got back into position. When I heard action, I leaped up, and same song, second verse. I'm not doing this another time, I told the director. This cameraman has no idea what he's doing. The whole production was lost in translation. In fact, I'm not sure how we even got that film done. It was an absolute disaster. I later heard that George Cukor, who had been the original director of Gone with the Wind until he was replaced, had wanted to turn The Blue Bird into his Gone with the Wind. That approach obviously did not work, as the film was critically skewered upon release. And incidentally, I also heard that the movie's sound man had been madly in love with Liz Taylor. During filming, so went the grapevine chatter, the man wandered by Liz's dressing room to give her something. When she opened the door, she was wearing an old frock like a frumpy housewife, and her hair was all over the place. She wasn't the Liz Taylor of his fantasy, but a mortal just like the rest of us. From that day forward, it seems like everything with the production went south. Still, there was one bright spot. I got on well with Jane Fonda. She knew I'd lost my mother, and when I arrived in Moscow, she embraced me. Do you know how worried we were about you, she said. I will always remember her kindness. On set and off, we talked constantly, and she was as passionate about her causes then as she is now. Through the early 1970s, she had been protesting against the Vietnam War, a move that made some people question her patriotism. She is, at her core, a fighter and a Sagittarian like me. In the United States, protest is our birthright, but when you exercise that right, you are often penalized for it. Jane, by then, had discovered that. I didn't spend much time offset with Ava Gardner or Liz Taylor, who was then Hollywood's darling. My dust-up with Liz would come years later on a different project. Liz and I both took our pets with us to Moscow. She had two dogs, I don't recall what breeds, while I had my Lhasa Apso called Stuff, for no reason in particular other than that I liked that name. I'd spotted Stuff on the same day I left for Moscow. From the moment I saw his little nose pressed up against the storefront glass window, I was smitten. In Moscow, Liz turned her dogs over to the caretaker of the property at which we stayed, whereas I let Susan, the assistant traveling with me, care for Stuff. While we were on set working during 18-hour days, the caretaker fell in love with Liz's dogs. Near the end of the filming, Liz said to me, "I don't have the heart to ask him for them back," and she indeed left them in Russia. I brought Stuff home with me during what turned out to be a thunderbolt of an exit. George had asked the crew to stay on a while longer to reshoot some scenes that his Russian-speaking crew had failed to capture. I refused. Our film dates, outlined in my contract, had already come and gone, and I was eager to get back to my life in the United States. A contract is a contract. Also, Moscow isn't exactly the tropics, and after weeks layered in every piece of clothing I'd packed, I was frozen. And then there was the bland Russian cuisine, which did little for my West Indian taste buds. I was cold, I was hungry, I was grieving my mother. Plus, I'd already committed to do another movie back in Los Angeles. Filming was to start shortly. I asked my assistant Susan to arrange for my departure. No flights out of Leningrad were immediately available, so she booked me on a train from Leningrad to Zurich, and from there, after a tussle with airport officials who tried to ban me from traveling with my dog, I flew on to Los Angeles. I told no one in the crew I was leaving. Somehow or another, while I was en route home, word got around to Frank Sinatra that Russia was giving me a hard time crossing its borders with a pet. Frank and I go way back to the days when we both played in the 1966 film A Man Called Adam. Frank called my agent Haber and said, "I hear they won't let Cicely Tyson out of Russia. Can I help?" What a gracious offer. But by then, child, I'd already made my own way back to the offices of 20th Century Fox, the distributor of the Bluebird, before anyone on George Cukor's crew even knew I was gone. While I was at the studio, one of the execs picked up the phone to call George in Russia. "Do you know where Cicely Tyson is?" the exec asked. "She's in her suite," George answered. "No, she isn't," the studio head said, laughing. "She's sitting here at my desk in Beverly Hills." Around the business, I have sometimes been called difficult. The truth is that I insist upon respect. I don't take any tea for the fever, child. Even now, at age 96, I teach folks not to mess with me. The year after my mother went home to heaven, Miles went missing here on Earth. By then, he'd taken a hiatus from music, and as he put down his horn, he picked up his drug habit again. Word around town was that he'd sunk to his lowest. I'd gotten to know Miles's eldest daughter, Cheryl, during the years when Miles and I were first together. In 1975, with desperation in her voice, she called me. "We can't find Father," she said, referring to Miles, as she and her siblings always did. I pressed the phone closer to my ear. "What do you mean you can't find him, Cheryl?" I asked. "Nobody has seen or heard from him," she replied. He'd gone out to San Francisco weeks earlier, she told me. But since then, neither his housekeeper, Berlina, nor anyone else in his family had gotten a call. In California, Miles had been staying with a couple he knew well, the same friends who'd breathed life back into him years earlier when he'd overdosed. They were the ones who told her he was missing. "Well, I have no idea where he is," I told her. Though I hadn't seen Miles since the day he'd stumbled into my hotel suite stoned, and though we'd certainly had our moments of strife, I of course still regarded him as a friend. And as a friend, I was concerned. I knew the couple that Miles had stayed with and called them myself. I wish to God I could recall their names, but time has dimmed that from memory. The wife answered when I rang. When they hadn't heard from Miles for a couple of days, her husband had put out the word around town, even asking about him in the dope houses Miles frequented. "We've talked to everybody we know," she told me. "We've gone every place that he hangs out, even asked about him among the dealers. Nobody has seen him." Over the next week, I checked in with both the woman and Cheryl. "Any luck?" I'd ask. "Dead or alive?" "No word." Finally, the following week, a dealer spotted Miles in a street gutter. His face was covered in spit and vomit, his eyes glued shut. He was unconscious, in a drug coma. The man leaned over, took Miles's pulse, and once he realized he was still alive, he called the couple. The husband arrived a short time later, and to avoid unfavorable press attention, he decided against taking Miles to the hospital. Instead, he and the dealer hoisted Miles's limp body into the back seat of the car. He then drove him to his home and called Cheryl, who called me. "We found him," she told me, relief in her voice. "And he's alive." Barely. The couple did everything they could think of to nurse Miles back to consciousness, including putting cold compresses on his face every hour as he lay in bed. But he would not wake up. The wife called me daily with updates. "He's breathing," she said, "but he's still unconscious." Finally, on the third day, Miles cracked open his lids and stared blankly at her as if she were a stranger. To spark his memory, she played some of his records and began talking to him about his children, his music, his life in New York. That did the trick. When she mentioned his daughter Cheryl, Miles lifted his hand toward hers as if the world had leapt into color. The woman took Miles's hand, cold as clay, and would not let go. Though his eyes were open, he did not speak. That evening, the husband sat Miles up on the side of his bed. Miles then tried to stand, but as he did, his legs buckled and he collapsed. The couple, each on one side of Miles, lifted him up and led him to the bathroom. "Let's take him to the shower," the husband said, hoping some cool water would hasten his recovery. Miles sat on the tub's edge, looking down at his feet and up at the shower head as a waterfall descended. They dried him off, put him in some pajamas, and helped him back into bed. He was still mute. That dear couple hovered over Miles as he alternated between the chills, sweats, and nausea brought on by his drug withdrawal. Finally, after 3 weeks, he was strong enough to fly home to New York. When the couple told him how worried I'd been, he began weeping. Cheryl called me with the news of Miles's recovery and travel plans, saying that when she talked to him, he sounded like himself. Miles and I never spoke directly at that time. Frankly, there was little to say. My concern from afar, an act of friendship born purely of my care for him, had spoken clearly enough. 18. Roots. Everywhere in the world I go, folks still come up to me, palms over their hearts, and whisper, "Roots." Though I've played more than 100 roles in my time, many of which have fallen from memory, millions will forever know me as Binta, mother of Kunta Kinte, the Gambian man at the center of Alex Haley's epic saga, Roots. Over 8 nights in the winter of 1977, the nation sat in rapt attention as the story of Haley's ancestry, starting with Kinte's birth and winding its way through 2 continents and 7 generations, unfolded on their televisions. It's a testament to God's handiwork that Roots came to include my portrayal. A couple of years earlier, when Jane Pittman was complete, I went away to Rancho La Puerta, Mexico, for a 2-week vacation. Near the end of it, my agent Haber called me. "Hurry up and get back here," he said. "I've got some big things going for you." Soon as I arrived at his place, he gave me a copy of The Ledger, a crime thriller novel by Dorothy Unack, and told me to read it. The book's main character, Christy O'Para, works as an undercover detective, a white New York City policewoman who prances through town half naked with her skirt up to her crotch as a decoy to ensnare criminals. ABC had adapted the story for the small screen in a series to be called Get Christy Love, featuring a black female lead. ABC had me in mind to play Christy, Haber explained. The more I read, the lower my heart sank. He must be crazy if he thinks I'm taking part in this foolishness, I thought. Surely there had to be a mistake. The next day, I called Haber at his office. Are you sure you gave me the right book? I asked him. Yes, he said. What's the matter? I paused. I know you don't expect me to do this, I told him. And if you do, I continued, I am telling you right now I will not. It's interesting that when the network heads adapted the novel to the screen, they reimagined it with a black woman as basically a prostitute, a narrative in line with the many featured in the blaxploitation films of that era, not to mention a reinforcement of the very stereotype I'd been attempting with my choice of roles to counter. That wasn't the surprise. The real stunner was that they thought that I, on the heels of having earned every accolade imaginable for portraying the dignified Jane Pittman, would even consider such a role. Between that and the ignorance I'd witnessed while traveling this country to address outright bigotry against black people, no way was I about to strip down to play a hooker with a badge. All right, Haber said, let's meet and talk. I had little more to say. That evening when he arrived at the house, I repeated my misgivings. Are you sure you won't even consider it? He said. I nodded, and his eyes filled with tears. And in that moment, I said to myself, oh boy, he's in trouble. It occurred to me that he'd already agreed that I would do the role. He did not admit that, nor did he have to. His expression gave it away. As he lowered his gaze to the floor, I knew the truth. If I did not show up on set the following week, his job could be in jeopardy, which is why I relented. I'll meet with the producers and maybe do just one episode, I told him, but they'll need to find someone to replace me. The color returned to his face as he thanked me profusely. The day before I was to show up at ABC, a fungus developed under the big toenail of my left foot. Take some olive oil, heat it up, and soak your foot in it, a friend told me. That'll pull the infection right out. I unearthed my glass electric kettle, filled it with water and a touch of oil, and plugged it in. Moments later from the living room, I heard the kettle boiling and rushed to the kitchen to unplug it. I then wrapped a cold, wet rag around the glass canister to cool it off. That's when the glass cracked into pieces and shattered onto my foot, along with a flood of scalding water. I crawled to the phone and called Haber, who rang for an ambulance. Doctors later confirmed what my foot, red and throbbing, had already told me. I'd suffered third-degree burns. The nurses wrapped my foot tightly, urged me to stay off of it for at least 3 weeks, and sent me home on crutches. Call ABC and tell them I won't be there, I said to Haber. To this day, he swears I burned myself deliberately just to get out of the role. Now I know how serious you are about your work, he told me. Truth is, though it had been an accident, I was relieved. Because the closer I got to the first day of playing a role that turned my stomach, the more conflicted I felt. This is God's work, I thought, and I'm not going to question it. As I limped my way through the next few weeks, the producers began auditioning potential replacements. They eventually discovered one in Teresa Graves, the actress who'd played in the long-running TV sketch comedy Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In. David Wolper, whose production company produced the series, called me. We found someone, Ms. Tyson, he said, chuckling. But you owe me one. Months later, he also said to me, you were right not to do Christy Love. As it turned out, that girl was so unhappy in that role that she eventually left the business and became a Jehovah's Witness. Years later, she tragically died in a house fire. 2 years later, in 1976, that same producer, David Wolper, called me again. I have a role for you, he said. His production company, he explained, had just started work on the TV miniseries Roots. "And remember," he said, laughing, "you owe me one." I smirked. "Well, I'm not gonna do it for nothing," I told him. Like Alfrey, I was tired of studios paying me pennies, only to turn around and make a mint. "Of course not," he said. "I'll call your agent and we'll discuss it." 1 week later, for a sum more respectable than any I'd ever earned up to then, I signed on to play Binta, mother of Kunta Kinte, in a film that would shake the nation to its core. The book preceded the miniseries, but only by a few months. In the fall of 1976, before the film aired in January 1977, Alex Haley's Roots, the saga of an American family, debuted to critical and commercial fanfare, ultimately spending 46 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, 22 of them at number one, and earning Haley a Pulitzer Prize and a National Book Award special citation. The book went on to sell 6 million copies. But what appeared to be an overnight success had actually spanned more than a decade. Haley, who'd merited acclaim for his 1965 collaboration, The Autobiography of Malcolm X, became curious about his own ancestry. In his family's rich oral tradition, Haley's grandmother had passed along stories of their ancestor Kunta Kinte, a young Muslim man who'd been enslaved during his teen years and shipped to America during the treacherous 4-month-long Middle Passage. Family lore told that Kinte obstinately refused to trade his given name for Toby, the one forced upon him by his new masters. Haley followed that trail to the shores of West Africa, where, armed only with this oral history and the name Kunta Kinte, portrayed in his younger years in the film by LeVar Burton, he began tracing his family's lineage with the help of a Gambian griot or storyteller. That search, over 12 long years, gave birth to Roots. I met Alex Haley soon after his book had been published. As his story gripped readers around the nation and world, he began hosting forums, town hall gatherings, much like those I'd participated in after the release of Sounder. I took part in a few of his forums, which is how he and I first became acquainted. I adored him from the first meeting, when our rich conversations weaved and bobbed through the story of how his book came to be. When I find someone who stimulates me intellectually as he did, that person can never get rid of me. What an extraordinary human being Alex Haley was, both soft-spoken and humble. Over the years of our friendship, and these days I can hardly recall a time when he wasn't in my life, he rarely raised his voice above a whisper. Few would have guessed that the gale winds unleashed by Malcolm X and Roots flowed from such an even-tempered soul. Like many talented artists, he let his pen do his picketing. God began preparing me for Roots years before the series was even a thought. I had traveled to Africa for the first time in 1967 to the kingdom of Dahomey, tucked between Togo and Nigeria in present-day Benin. My work on The Comedians, the film co-starring Liz Taylor and Richard Burton, is what took me there. The story was set in Haiti, but because of political conflict there, the film was shot in Dahomey. The movie was a forgettable flop, but the vivid colors, aromas, and sounds of Africa still dance in my memory. Away from filming, I traveled the country with a translator, talking to women who gathered at the shoreline to wash their clothes, witnessing the rich community and uproarious laughter around supper tables, relishing the vibrant flavors of maize, yams, and peanut stew served from their wooden tables. I did not speak their language, but I knew these women. the abiding care that knits together the African-American community, that profound intuitiveness and palpable spirituality that has always been within us, it is present in Mother Africa. In truth, it originated there. I was studying and didn't know it. The Dahomian women wore their bushels of hair in elaborate braided styles, each parted to perfection and often signaling their tribal affiliations. The Bantu knots I donned in roots are like those I spotted during my travels, and on set with my hairdresser, Omar, I insisted the style be precisely replicated. So much of great acting is about paying attention to the passing world, and every morning while in Africa, I homed in on the details of their grooming habits. The people there never used soap and water on their skin. Rather, they washed their faces with the juice they'd squeezed from leaves. I don't know what was in those leaves, but I hardly ever saw anyone with a pimple. At sunup, before the women began their daily work, they'd clean their teeth using bark they'd stripped from a tree. And, by the way, they had perfect teeth. When I returned home to New York and walked along 125th Street in Harlem, I chuckled when I spotted African immigrants, street salesmen, doing the same thing, sitting on boxes alongside their wares, using a piece of bark as a homemade toothbrush. Like a great many traditions our ancestors brought to America, they carried that practice with them. I brought those memories with me onto the set of Roots. A few years later, I returned to Africa, this time as part of a tour with the United Nations. On our journey to the remote villages of Senegal, I had the privilege of being present alongside an impoverished woman as she gave birth in a makeshift ward on the springs of a tattered iron bed with a thin sheet draped over her. She'd lost a baby during childbirth the year before. I was asked to come see her as a way to ease the anxiety that might clasp shut one's womb following such a tragedy. Between her fluent French and my broken version, we greeted each other as I took a seat near her. She was sweating profusely in a sweltering room with no air conditioner or fan. I pulled out a packet of wipes from my pocketbook and wiped her forehead. She commented on the scent of its perfume. I smiled and nodded, and then folded her hand into mine. I told the few corny French jokes I knew, attempting to distract her from the labor pains. Never once did she scream or cry, not a single sound. I kept thinking, they gave her something. But the nurse said she hadn't had an epidural or any of the other anesthetics we take for granted in the United States. Other than the sweat, I could hardly even tell this woman was having a child. Next thing I knew, the nurse was shouting, "I see the head!" As doctors directed the woman to push, there wasn't an ounce of strain on her face. Moments later, her baby boy, swaddled and wailing, lay pressed against her bosom. Little did I know I'd one day be called upon to portray the birthing experience of an African woman. On the first day of filming, I asked the director, "Do you want a silent birth?" I told him about the one I'd witnessed in Senegal. The director, it turned out, wanted a conventional labor, complete with moaning and screaming. And I gave him precisely what he requested. Binta's birthing scene opens the film, just as it does the book. Wrote Haley, early in the spring of 1750 in the village of Jufure, 4 days upriver from the coast of the Gambia, West Africa, a man-child was born to Omoro and Binta Kinte. Forcing forth from Binta's strong young body, he was black as she was, flecked and slippery with Binta's blood, and he was bawling. Maya Angelou, the Almighty, who played my mother in Nioboto, joined me in moving that passage from page to screen on our film set in Savannah, Georgia, a location chosen in part because the vegetation there resembles that of the Gambia. My character during that scene served as my salve. What a blessing it was to just fold myself into Binta, to forget my mourning for a time. My mother, by then, had been gone for 2 years, but the ache lingered. Stepping into Binta's labor was how I divorced myself from my own grief. Binta's birthing scene was, of course, imaginary. There I lay, legs open, with a sheet pulled over my lower half, and the camera aimed only at the agony on my face. And yet the anguish behind those primal wails could not have been more real. Binta, for me, was more than a character. She was my catharsis. Portraying Binta also gave me a scorching back. Perched above me on set stood a row of bright lights, as well as some kind of heating instrument for only God knows what purpose. That equipment set my entire back on fire, from the shoulders down. Initially, I thought the Georgia sun, unforgiving as it is hot, had lit me ablaze. But even once shooting was done, I kept on burning. I finally showed my blistering shoulders to one of the producers and said, "You'd better get me a nurse." The nurse administered a topical treatment that eased the pain well enough for me to continue. Back to shooting we went during 18-hour days, with me grunting and screaming while giving birth. We shot that opening scene so many times, I'd nearly lost my voice by the end of filming. As my newborn makes his grand entrance, my mother stands proudly at my rear, wiping sweat from my brow. My husband, Omoro, played by Thalmas Rasulala, dashes into the villa upon hearing the first cries of our son. "We will give him a very good life," I whisper, to which Omoro replies, "We've given him life, Binta, good or not good. That is for Allah to say." 8 days later, Omoro, in keeping with the African tradition, bestows upon his son a name that will be echoed through the centuries. Soon after, the father cradles his swaddled newborn in the crease of his elbow as he strides into a dark forest. He kneels to the ground, gently unwraps his treasure, and lifts him toward the maker of the heavens. "Kunta Kinte," he proclaims as he holds the squirming child beneath the starry firmament. "Behold, the only thing greater than yourself." That scene, in all of its rhetorical potency and visual splendor, would come to define Roots in the hearts of millions. Roots felt like a gamble for ABC. The executives there had a gripping historical drama on their hands, based on a book that had already riveted the masses, that much they knew. But above that certainty hung a pair of questions. Would white folks tune in for a generational slave narrative featuring a mostly black cast? And if they did tune in, would they turn away in guilt, denial, or grief over their foreparents' savage treatment of blacks? Perhaps with those questions in mind, the series' writers created a white slave captain with a moral compass. Thomas Davies, portrayed by Ed Asner. Such a sympathetic character did not appear in Haley's volume. His inclusion would make the plotline more palatable for Caucasians, or so went the thinking. Still, even after the storyline had been softened, there was a whole lot of hand-wringing leading up to airtime. To increase the series' chance of success, ABC had filled the cast with a slew of familiar black faces, including John Amos, O.J. Simpson, and Louis Gossett Jr. Ahead of Roots' release in January 1977, the studio screened all 8 hours of the series for a mostly white Los Angeles audience. The theater was jammed to the rafters. I was in attendance, and when the film ended, you could have heard a hair hit the floor. No one moved or said a word for several minutes. In my mind, viewers' silence likely meant the film's message had reverberated, but it scared the daylights out of the already nervous network heads. Not only were they not sure how Middle America would respond to the story, but talk soon swirled of what they secretly feared, that blacks, gazing anew upon the barbarism we've endured in this nation, would riot. The ABC team's initial plan, I heard, had been to roll out the film over 8 weeks, with an hour for each episode, and yet doing so would have extended the series into sweeps, the period when Nielsen surveys television viewership habits and sets advertising rates. The bigger a network's audience during sweeps, the more it can charge advertisers for commercial spots. Some of the ABC heads were terrified they'd lose sweeps by airing Roots, which is why they chose to get it on and get it off quick during 8 straight nights. I'm sure those executives later wished they'd had a crystal ball, because from the opening night to the final credits, Americans were mesmerized by the series. The ratings reached beyond the stunning to the stratospheric. Approximately 130 million viewers tuned in to some part of Roots, more than half of the U.S. population then, and 85% of those with televisions tuned in. With each installment, the viewership rose as people of all stripes canceled plans to huddle in their living rooms. Bars and bistros, theaters and casinos emptied out as folks raced home to witness our fraught history unfold on the small screen. The final episode, which aired on January 30, 1977, catapulted Roots into the record books. That episode, at the time, was the most watched in television history. Even now, it is still the 5th most watched non-Super Bowl show of all time. Roots was eventually bested only by the last episode of MASH in 1983, the final episode of Cheers in 1993, the Whodunit episode of Dallas in 1980, and the Seinfeld finale in 1998. It even drew more viewers than the Apollo 11 moon landing in 1969, which was telecast across all networks. Roots was more than a prime-time phenomenon set to a soul-stirring soundtrack by the masterful Quincy Jones. It was a national meeting around the village well, the start of a reckoning that bears a resemblance to the one of our current times. Roots' ratings were eclipsed only by its cultural impact. In the summer of 1976, 6 months before the series aired, the nation had celebrated the bicentennial, America's 200th birthday, in which the African-American perspective felt glaringly absent. Haley's tale became a counterpoint. With the airing of Roots, the historical record had at last been rendered more complete, with the testimony of the persecuted featured right alongside that of the captors. The bestiality of the slave trade was no longer buried. Roots brought slavery's cruelty to life in vivid and searing color, with images capable of haunting even the most cold-hearted. ABC had feared that whites might cringe, and some may have, but millions also leaned in to a new social consciousness. Seldom had there been so many kitchen table conversations about our nation's original sin and our place as descendants in that legacy. For whites, the series prompted an awakening to the horrors of a not-so-distant past. Perhaps surprisingly to some, Roots also served that purpose for blacks, many of whom did not know, and still don't, the full extent to which our ancestors were dehumanized. Everyone, it seemed, had been moved by some on-screen moment in Roots. Whether it was the day Kunta was captured and herded onto the Lord Ligonier ship for the voyage to America, or the time, amid lashings from his slave master, he at last relented and took the name Toby. Even the few who hadn't watched the series got swept up in the national obsession, as Roots crawled under our collective skin and stayed. The television community acknowledged as much by awarding the series a record-setting 37 Emmy nominations and 6 wins. As I see it, Roots resonated because it touched a nerve that runs far deeper than race: family identity. The human desire to know where we've come from and who our foreparents were is a universal longing that transcends ethnicity. When you know your history, you know your value. You know the price that has been paid for you to be here. You recognize what those who came before you built and sacrificed for you to inhabit the space in which you dwell. In sharing the story of his one tribe, Haley precipitated a curiosity and a question for millions. What is my own family history? Like never before, people of all backgrounds began researching their ancestries, wondering how their pasts had given birth to their present lives. Looking into one's heritage became and still is a national fascination. Judging by the scores of folks who approached me with tears in their eyes as they spoke of the series, I felt like I'd been part of educating the entire world. Decades before I portrayed Binta, I'd longed to discover more about my own ancestry. Roots deepened that yearning. I knew the few stories my mother and father had passed on to me, the tales of resilience and survival that I've recounted in these pages. But sadly, I never met any of my grandparents in Nevis, never had the opportunity to ask them about their lives or those of their parents and grandparents. For African Americans in particular, genealogical research can be frustrating, with dead ends around every corner. Records don't often exist for the enslaved, who, when they were even counted, were frequently numbered as chattel rather than as human. When our ancestors were sold away from their homelands, their voices were silenced beneath the crack of their masters' whips. That is why it is so meaningful when we manage, through documentation, to unearth even the tiniest breadcrumbs of our past. Knowing your generational story firms the ground upon which you stand. It makes your life, your struggles and triumphs, bigger than your lone existence. It connects you to a grand plotline. While I was writing this book, I called up Dr. Henry Louis Gates, Jr., director of the Hutchins Center for African and African American Research at Harvard University, and host of the award-winning PBS documentary series, Finding Your Roots. Dr. Gates and I have known each other for years, and each time I saw him, I'd mention eventually wanting to uncover my family tree. He was, of course, eager to do so as soon as I gave him the word. Finally, in the fall of 2019, I rang him and said, "I'm ready." He and his team began the process of researching my full ancestry, but weeks into their exploration, they encountered a heartbreaking impasse. In Nevis, most of my family's critical records had been lost during a fire, the remnants of my ancestry gone up in flames. I will never know why my mother's mother, Mary Jane Sargent, who was born in Barbados, left there on her own to settle in Nevis, or why she and Charles, my mother's father, never met.